changed out. Sweet liberty, sweet liberty is in us. It's part of the plan, or is it a state of mind? Never forget.
You're listening to Jackie Patru and Sweet Liberty. And now, here's your host, Jackie Patru.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us tonight on Sweet Liberty. It is Wednesday. It is the end of our broadcast night. It is the 18th of May in the year 2005. I'm going to, in lieu of our spiritual message, I'm going to, I was trying to get that recorder going. I've got something here I want to share with you. It is of a spiritual nature, but it is longer than we normally do in the beginning of the broadcast. This is from somebody named Stu Wild, and this is of a that was forwarded to me, and I'm sorry I don't remember who forwarded it. He sent this to his list, evidently. Dear friends, I'm so happy you're on my list. Sometimes my life is rather lonely. Knowing you're all out there someplace is very reassuring to me. Thank you. Here's a short piece on ascending and descending emotions. It's another way of looking at the authentic spiritual you and how you feel about your place in eternity. I hope you like it. Sincerely, Stewie Wild. This is titled Rising Feelings and Descending Emotions. He said, I went to visit my friend, Ralph Miller, who runs the heart of the Initiate Ayahuasca temples in Brazil. He told me a very interesting perception he had about the nature of rising and descending emotions. Ideas that begin in the mind and drift down to the heart to become emotions are considered to be descending. They're often the result of an affirmation or a contradiction of the ego's opinions. So, pleasing events that confirm what your intellect wants in life evoke happiness, while events that contradict your intellect's desires evoke negative emotions. So a descending emotion is a reaction in your heart to an intellectual opinion. Ascending feelings are more primal. They're initiated in the heart, and they rise up to the intellect to be unraveled and understood. Sometimes they're not easily put into words. There is a beauty and an empathy to them. It's a mother's love for a child. It's crying at the beauty of a sunset. It's being mesmerized by the sound of flowing water and so forth. It's a moment when your mind stands still and you feel yourself suddenly connected to all things. That is the ascendant feeling. It's like falling back into the arms of God. Miller told me, now folks, I don't know that this is so, what you're about to hear, but it certainly is worth considering and maybe even some further research, or maybe it's just this Mr. Miller's his own hypothesis, so to speak. He says, Miller told me that because Western civilization is almost totally devoid of DMT. That's dimethyltryptamine. Dimethyltryptamine, DMT. Miller told me that because Western civilization is almost totally devoid of DMT in the pineal gland, the rising feelings and primal emotions of humanity and are almost completely lost. The natural empathy we should have for each other just doesn't feel natural, no matter how hard we try. We've cut ourselves off from nature and from other humans. We say, I love you, but they are hollow words from the mind without any real warmth or feelings behind them. It's not an invocation to another's divinity, a connection to the God force within them that would come from the primal connection of the heart. Humans fire DMT in large quantities at birth and at death, so we arrive on Earth in a trance state and we depart the same way. The near-death experience of trauma victims is thought to be a DMT firing, and the pineal is known to be active for about 45 minutes after death, which is very mysterious. Why the modern Western lifestyle destroys DMT in the pineal is not readily understood. It may be due to stress and nutrition, but it is also because the visionary function of the pineal is crushed and beaten out of us early in childhood. So the pineal's DMT activity atrophies for lack of use. As a society, we only endorse logic. We don't support a child's imaginary friends or his or her phantasmagorical dream world. We train a child to become a thinker, a performer in a commercial world, a follower of logic and socially approved assumptions. What I'm thinking about as I was reading this, folks, and I know you can relate to this, to the apparently or seemingly lack of empathy and compassion in younger people today, is the brain research that they've done and certain things that they do and have done to children in the government indoctrination centers that we called schools at one time. Is it a possibility that what we're reading here is true and it is part of the process of dehumanizing human beings? Because when we lose our ability to feel compassion and true warmth of love, not just as this thing says, say I love you, but to actually feel it within us, within our hearts, and to compare in the compassion and the caring for complete strangers, if you would. I'll go back a bit. As a society, we only endorse logic. No, never mind. I don't have to read that again. So you can better understand our world of yang and war and the competitiveness of dog-eat-dog. It's the manifestation of cruel, descending emotions of a mind devoid of the one critical chemical. It's the cold world of thinkers with their judgments, parameters, rules, and evaluations, rather than the natural warmth of visionaries and dreamers. Democracy is intellectualized as the relatively inconsequential act of one man, one vote. In fact, democracy in its primal emotion is a connection to others. It's being able to love a complete stranger and to care for them and to be polite and respect who they are, especially if they're very different to you. Democracy is an empathy, a natural compassion. It's feeling the same as others, allowing them into your soul rather than distancing yourself from them. I wonder when they started, I don't know how long ago this happened, when they started saying, I need my space, don't come into my space, and et cetera, et cetera. Do you see what that, psychologically, what that does when people talk about, I need my own space? Actually, we're all in this space together, aren't we, folks? And with lots of others in other dimensions that we can't see with our physical eyes, and unless we finally have eyes to see and ears to hear. But I thought that very odd. I remember when that saying started, and of course, that doesn't just happen. And it's just kind of an accepted thing today. I need my space. And then this goes on, it's just a couple more paragraphs. Our linear world doesn't allow for other dimensions and the vast inner universe of trans-dimensional perception. It's often ridiculed as not there. But quantum physics has proven mathematically it is there. In fact, we exist in those dimensions all the time. It's a hyperspace potential we all have as a birthright. Ayahuasca, this must be some type of a discipline. Ayahuasca replaces DMT in the pineal, and that is why it opens the inner door to the other worlds. You can't take ayah and ever remain the same. Once DMT levels are restored in your brain, the primal emotion of remembering begins. You remember who you are, and those emotions ascend from the heart to the mind, and they instantly change the way you think. We become less fake and more authentic. It's the difference between pretending to be warm and actually being loving and warm. In the 90s, I wrote a book called Whispering Winds of Change. In it, I said that the world would split into three evolutions: the curved path of dogma and elitism, the technological path of global control via electronic wizardry, and the open parabola of the visionary path. Only the visionary path survives long term. This is because the 10-dimensional phantasmagorical world folds over our 3-dimensional world, and as it does, dogma, technology, and logic will become meaningless. The world we know will be swept away. Dogma and technological control are cold and devilish, while the open path is warm and potentially godlike. It's the ability to walk into those other dimensions and see and remember that allows you to evolve away from the curved trajectories of ego, logic, and dogma, and control toward the next evolution. So the choice is an evolution of descending emotions of a mind depleted of DMT, or the ascending emotions of a heart that has the language of the shamans as its poetry. And that is why I have felt that ayahuasca is so vital to people's perception and spirituality. For without a boost of DMT that ayah provides, they may never arrive at the trans-dimensional door, no matter how genuine they are or how hard they try. We need the language of the shamans to read and understand the book of our evolution. It's weird to think that almost all the mayhem of the world comes only from a very slight chemical imbalance in the pineal, and all the human angels and would-be rescuers and kind people comes from a slight surplus of the same chemical. Strange but true. And this is copyrighted Stuart Wild, 2005. And StuartWild.com. I haven't gone to his website, but I thought this quite, more than just interesting. More than just interesting. Here's something I wanted you to hear. I haven't received the conference report yet, by the way. Today is Wednesday. I ordered it last Friday. They said I would have it within 2 to 3 days, so maybe by tomorrow, and maybe by Monday, I'll have, over the weekend, I'll have had an opportunity to read some of it if I get it in time, of the I need to tell you what I'm talking about, don't I? The conference report, which turns out to be the bill that was passed appropriating $82 more billion for the war in Iraq, for and also creating the national ID, except that the national ID is not just, quote, national. It would be good for the Union of the Americas, I guess we would call it. Canada, America, Mexico, but really all of South America. But this is an item that was in Counterpunch, and it's not very long. And I just wanted you to hear this. It's titled Carte Blanche for the Terror Cops, dated May 11, 2005. Senate gives Department Homeland Security power to waive all laws, by Robert Scholl. It says, in passing the Iraq War Supplemental yesterday, the Senate also gave the Secretary of Homeland Security the power to waive any and all law in the course of building roads and barriers along the U.S. borders without limit and with no checks and balances. Let me read that one again. In passing the Iraq War Supplemental, the Senate also gave the Secretary, a man, a one, in fact, remember, Michael Chertoff, a Russian Jew, who is now the Tsar, the Homeland Security Tsar in the United States of America, folks. Senate gave the Security of Homeland Secretary of Homeland Security the power to waive any and all law in the course of building roads and barriers along the U.S. borders without limit and with no checks and balances. The measure is part of the Real ID Act of 2005, the controversial immigration bill attached by the House as a rider to the Iraq War Supplemental. By the way, this Robert Scholl is Director of Regulatory Policy at OMB Watch. The consequence of this decision is that Congress has given one man a license to waive any law for any reason or for no reason at all. Michael Chertoff, Secretary of Homeland Security, now has the power to simply waive away laws that protect the environment, safeguard public health, ensure consumer and workplace safety, prevent unfair business practices, and ban discrimination at his sole and unreviewable discretion. Oh, right, like he's going to do all that stuff? No, I don't think so. But you see how these things are written, folks? Actually, it looks pretty innocuous, doesn't it, to the average person who isn't paying attention. There is too much at stake to grant any government officials the power to waive all law. Immediately at stake, of course, are current environmental protections in the vicinity of the borders, but even more is at stake. These fences and roads will not build themselves. They must be put in place by workers who could lose all their workplace safety protections as well as their rights to collective bargaining or even overtime pay. The new power comes completely without limit. Every law from child labor to ethical contracting can now be waived. It's between the lines that you have to read here, isn't it? Excuse me. Congressional supporters of this measure would like us to believe that the measure means only that DHS can speed up completion of one small stretch of fence in the Smuggler's Gulch. You know, they're acting like there's actually security at our borders, aren't they, here in this article, folks? That's what it makes it sound like, doesn't it? Nothing could be further from the truth. This measure is written so that Michael Chertoff will have unlimited authority to waive all law in the course of building roads and barriers and removing obstacles to the direction of illegal immigrants, and it applies anywhere in the vicinity of the borders. earlier versions of Earlier versions of this provision would have limited its scope just to environmental laws and just to Smuggler's Gulch, but the version now passed by both houses of Congress applies everywhere along the borders and applies to all laws on the books. There's the danger of this thing. We expect government officials to execute the law, and no government agency should be above the laws that preserve America's democracy. Congress has granted the Secretary of Homeland Security unbridled authority to act however he sees fit, with consequences, without consequence, accountability, and any opportunity for judicial review. And somebody pointed out that the term illegal immigrant is really a misnomer, because they're actually illegal aliens. Immigrants are people who immigrate into this country, according to that, but it made sense to me. Calling them illegal immigrants are calling them immigrants. They're not. They're intruders is what they are. And I want to remind you that in one of the reports I read about this new real ID card, that it's going to be much, go through a lot more hoopla for the average American to get a driver's license. But they're giving driver's licenses to illegal immigrants. And the illegal immigrants will have a notice on their driver's license that it can be used only for driving and not for identification. Isn't that something? Isn't that something? All right. What I've been reading to you the last couple nights was this item from Insight, and there's quite a bit more to it, but I read the rest of it last evening after I went to bed, and I'm not going to read it all to you, but I want to read about the communist uprise in Germany after World War One. I mean, I knew from reading Nesta Webster and other books that, well, and Hans Schmidt, who lived there and grew up there and was an SS Panzer Grenadier. In his book, I believe it might have been the book End Times, End Games, or it might have been in SS Panzer Grenadier, but he said that there were 100 and some political parties when Adolf Hitler was running for chancellor under the National Socialist Party. And they were all communist. They were all communist front groups. It was a mess over there, folks. And this is, I'm going to share this with you, this part of it, because details of it were news to me. The communist uprising in Germany after World War One. World War One was not over yet when the quote red seeds planted the year before started to grow in Germany. It all started in the city of Kiel, Germany, when the sailors of the German Navy started their mutiny on November 1st, 1918. The ringleaders were arrested by the authorities, and that brought it to a confrontation which ended bloody. The 1st Torpedo Division under Lieutenant Steinhauser tried to put the radicals under control, but they lost. By the time it was over, 30 torpedo men were dead, and the governor of that district, von Suchen, was murdered in his home. By November 5th, the red flags were on every ship. On the battleship Der König, the captain, Feniger, second-in-command, Hyman, and Lieutenant Zinker were just shot when they tried to prevent the takeover on their ship. Also in Berlin, Germany's capital, the communists got busy setting up the Spartacus League, whose leader, Karl Liebknecht, was just released from jail. Next to him was Rosa Luxemburg, who fought for Lenin in the Russian Communist Revolution. She was not a German citizen. Their first news publication was the newspaper Rote Fawn, Red Flag, where that means red flag, where Rosa Luxemburg made her first announcement, quote, "The struggle for socialism is the greatest civil war in the history of the world, and the proletarian revolution must prepare the necessary arms for this civil war, learn to use them to fight and to gain victory," end quoting Rosa Luxemburg. Would you like to hear that again? 1918. "The struggle," she said, "the struggle for socialism is the greatest civil war in the history of the world, and the proletarian revolution must prepare the necessary arms for this civil war, learn to use them to fight and to gain victory," end quoting. That was the time when communism became active all over Germany, and they were a real threat to become successful. Berlin was one of the hottest places in Germany, and the city had to defend itself very seriously several times. Liebknecht and Luxemburg had their head offices in Berlin, and their priority was to take Berlin first, the capital of Germany. Liebknecht was a very convincing speaker, and a large percentage of the German working class joined him in his bloody uprise. The Spartacists went through the city taking anything they wanted. Stores, supermarkets were robbed all over, and anyone who stood up to them to prevent it was killed. The news media was totally in control of the Spartacists, and the government had to produce flyers and hand them out on the streets of Berlin to get their message out. Factories that were needed to produce the daily needs of the people were destroyed, or the workers went on strike. Large areas of Berlin were without water and power because of it. The soldiers, you know, when you read about this and what was going on there, it makes you understand why there were some very strict regulations under the National Socialist Party in Germany, doesn't it, folks? They had to. And I could see that with all of the communists that had infiltrated, and my goodness, they were right there at the back door, or the side door, we might say, it would seem almost impossible to have kept them out. And that's the way, evidently, that they gained so much control in Germany before Adolf Hitler came into his chancellorship. The German soldiers coming home from the front lines started their battle on January 11, 1919 in Berlin. They lost 7 soldiers that were shot dead, and 11 soldiers were wounded. The Spartacists were defeated and went into hiding, but the two top leaders, Liebknecht and Luxemburg, were arrested and placed in the, quote, Eden Hotel. We're going to take a break right here, folks, for just a couple of minutes. And have your pen handy, and be sure to get the number where you can call if you want to get copies of these broadcasts. You can get the entire month on CD for $25, so listen closely. And remember, this broadcast is listener-sponsored, and that would be you. We're getting way behind. Again.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
If you'd like to get a copy of this program, there are a few ways that we can help you. You may subscribe at FirstAmendmentRadio.com for only $45 a month, and you'll receive an MP3 CD weekly of all of our programs. As a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online. That's a $15 value. Or you may request any month of any program on one MP3 CD for a minimum donation of only $25. Or any single program on tape, MP3 CD, or CD for only $15. You may do all of this online at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Just follow the instructions to make a donation or subscribe. Don't do internet? Then call 559-781-3773 and we'll be honored to help you. Thank you from all of us here at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Roll away the dough.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Be sure to visit the SweetLiberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
All right, that phone number again, in case you didn't get it down, if you want to order tapes, is you can do it on the internet, of course, but if you want to call 559-781-3773, and my address, folks, if you would like to see this broadcast stay on the air, I would have infinitely more time if I weren't doing it, and I know three nights a week, it isn't a lot of time, 3 hours a week, but it is the time beforehand, and maybe the thoughts and constant presence of this broadcast and what we're hopefully doing here in shedding light into the darkness of truth. And I don't listen to other broadcasts. I don't have time. If I stay in the room on Monday nights after the broadcast, I tune in to Darren. And for those of you who are on the internet, you know that Darren Weeks is on following Sweet Liberty on Monday nights, and he's also on Friday nights too. And boy, I'll tell you what, well, Chris Gerner, American Exposé, follows Sweet Liberty, and of course they're all worth listening to. Darren is, I had no idea when he volunteered those many years ago to put our website up. This is his contribution to the work that we're doing, because it is truly a labor of love, his building and maintaining of the sweetliberty.org website. Plus he has his own and has a full-time job and a family, and now doing Monday and Friday broadcasts in his desire to bring information to you. I had no idea that he had such wonderful skills as a broadcaster, but he did tell me that he had had his own program before. I think it was on, I don't know if it was on an AM station or not, but I just didn't realize how good he was. So be sure, even though I forget to tell you on Monday nights, stay tuned. And my address, if you didn't get it down, if you would like to see the broadcast continue, is Jackie Petrou, P-A-T-R-U, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, Pennsylvania, 16936. P.O. Box 190, Millerton, Pennsylvania, 16936. Oh, and I want to say hello to Tim. Tim is a listener who's also a broadcaster on mainstream radio and is finding maybe his own ways without coming out and saying things for those who have an ear to hear and an eye to see. And I wanted to say hello to Tim. And I don't want to say anything to get Tim in trouble either, so we'll leave it at that. Let me go back to this item that I was reading to you out of Insight. Germany after World War I, the communist uprise in Germany. It said that when the German soldiers came home from the front lines, January 11th, 1919, they started protecting and defending their nation against these communists. It says the Spartacus were defeated and went into hiding, but the two top leaders, Liebknecht and Luxembourg, were arrested and placed in the Eden Hotel. That's in quotes. I don't know what the Eden Hotel is, maybe just a prison. From there, the two should have been transported to the Moabiter jail in Berlin, but it never came to that. The people of Berlin and the soldiers found out about it, and while the police tried to transport Liebknecht and Luxembourg to the jail, a vicious, revengeful mob was waiting for them outside and murdered both of them, actually beating them to death. Arnold Zweig, a Jewish writer who received the National Prize in East Germany after World War II, wrote about Rosa Luxemburg on January 23, 1919. It said, quote, Rosa Luxemburg was a soldier who fought for human rights, and she believed in the old messianic tradition of being God's chosen people. She lost her battle on one side, but on the other side, she was successful and brought the people closer together. End quoting this Zweig guy. Arnold Zweig should be a bit more specific about, quote, bringing people close together. History proves that the communist uprise in Germany only brought people closer together in the cemeteries all over Germany. Now that the leaders of the communists in Berlin were gone, things quieted down for a while, and the Spartacus went into hiding, but not for long. Shortly after that, the communists were reorganized and started their next attack in Berlin on March 3, 1919. Without warning, the Red Mob attacked the main post office and police station in Berlin, murdering every single person in those buildings. You see, it sounds unreal. It sounds like a fantasy or maybe a movie, folks, because this never happened here. And I think it's very difficult for most of us to actually get it, that the evil that is used to promulgate this plan for world dominion, they choose their useful idiots carefully. And with their psychological profiles, Alan was explaining this. I think he's explained it to us on the air, but that they choose them very carefully, and they find those who basically seem to have merely a reptilian brain, the cold-hearted, the lack of feeling, and like he said, it's beyond evil. The word evil, the language, our language, really does not have words to describe, because it's out of this world. And that's why it's hard to imagine. The slaughter, the bloodshed. And we have no idea, do we? Can you picture? I can't picture what's going on over in Iraq. And I don't care how many newsreels you watch, you're not going to see what's really happening. I've read some terrible accounts that that have been emailed that soldiers have given, and some of them like cold animals. Some of them actually have taken their own home videos and put them to music, showing all the people that are dead and that they've killed. And I read one account where one guy was showing it actually to his family, and he had shot somebody, I guess, right in the face, and said, "Look at that! I blew his face right off." The people in the room watching it, of course, were in shock that he was so deadpanned about it, so emotionless about it. And evidently, from seeing their reactions, it began to occur to him what he was really doing. What kind of a mental state are these people in when they're over there, and they get shooting at live human beings, children, babies? It doesn't matter to them. And don't think it can't happen here, and it can. Now that the leaders of the communists in Berlin were gone, things quieted down for a while. Excuse me. I have already read that. Shortly after that, the communists were reorganized and started their next attack on Berlin. Okay, going into the police, okay. The police station and the post office, murdering every single person in those buildings. I actually had my finger right on the place, but I didn't know that. Again, it was the front soldiers who had created an organized team, the Free Corps, all volunteers, who took on the murderous mob and eventually defeated them. That battle started on March 3rd, and over 1,500 people were killed. Some of them were just innocent bystanders. The favorite spot of the Red Mafia was mostly the rooftops of houses, where they would just shoot into the crowd, killing innocent people. This was going on in most major German cities, and at the same time, the Allies were sitting in Versailles, bringing peace to the world, so they claimed. Another red hot spot was Munich in Bavaria, Germany, where the communist uprising also took many innocent lives. On November 13, 1918, Corporal Adolf Hitler was released from the reserve hospital in Peacewalk, where he had survived a gas attack by the British. And he arrived in Munich, still being a soldier. Even before World War I was over, the communist takeover took place in Munich, Bavaria, just as it did in Berlin and most other major cities in Germany. Kurt Eisner had a gathering of his supporters at the Theresien Weiss in Munich, a large empty field just outside the city. It was a huge gathering, and over 100,000 people showed up in Eisner's support. On that same day, Eisner and his supporters took over the city and became the rulers of Munich. The Bavarian king caught wind of the revolutionary takeover and had fled the country, and Eisner now placed himself on the king's throne. It did not take long until the people of Munich realized who had become their new leader, and they asked for new elections, which, of course, Eisner was not interested in. He thought he had it made, and he loved his new way of life, robbing, stealing, and killing those who were opposed to him. Eisner, whose parents were Eastern European Jews, made sure that all his close friends got leading positions in his new government, and all of them were Jews. Eisner made his close friend, Mr. Mussam, in charge of his bodyguards. It seems his bodyguards did not do a very good job. On February 21, 1919, Lieutenant Graf Arco Valley, his mother was Jewish, stepped in front of Eisner while he was walking on a street in Munich to go to the parliament and shot him in the face with a pistol, killing Eisner. The incident only put gas in the fire, and the red mob went berserk. Stealing and killing was something that happened daily. Mr. Moussam took over the communist leadership. Engelhofer became the commandant of Munich. Etaler was in charge of the Red Army in Bavaria. Levine, a Russian Jew, was the force. Hold it, please. I should bring a glass of water in here to sip when I'm doing this broadcast by myself. I guess that's why when people get up and speak on those at those podiums, they always have a glass of water to sip on. All right, with all this going on... Nope, I have to go back a little ways. E. Toller, the letter E, it's an initial E. Toller was in charge of the Red Army in Bavaria. Levine, a Russian Jew, was the force to bring communism to all of Germany and Western Europe. Mr. Weibel, a Russian prisoner of war, went and took hostages and threatened to kill them if his demands were not met. There were women among them, too. On April 10, 1919, he proved that he meant what he said when he had 10 hostages shot for no real reason. While all this was going on in Munich, the German Freikorps was getting ready to put an end to all that and surrounded the city. When the battle was over, 8 officers of the Freikorps, 60 soldiers, and 144 civilians were dead. This was going on in every major city in Germany, where not only Jews were killing Germans, but also Germans were killing each other. Germans were killing each other. Not long after that, the Allied powers outlawed the Freikorps. Oh, my, my, my. This is after World War I, folks. The Allied powers outlawed the Freikorps, a military unit of volunteers, and made Germany totally defenseless. Boy. This all happened before the Adolf Hitler Party, the NSDAP, the SA and the SS existed. But this was the reason why they came to exist. This was also the time when Adolf Hitler decided not to be an artist or an architect, but rather to go into politics. World War II, General Leon de Grau was right when he said Hitler was born in Versailles. This is one more incident told by historian Professor Dr. Hans Joachim Koch of the University of York, England. What communism in Germany was all about. This is quoting this professor. Quote, on January 29th, 1926, some boys of the Hitler Youth were placing posters on walls in the city of Berlin. Those kids were spotted. 1926? Oh, okay, that was when the party was... Because he was elected in 1933, but, of course, the party was growing at that time, I guess. Some boys of the Hitler Youth were placing posters on walls in the city of Berlin. Those kids were spotted by a group of communists, and they went after them. The communists went after the boys. They all got away except for one, Herbert Norkus, who got caught by the mob. Herbert got 2 knife wounds, but he managed to reach a door, and the owner of the house closed the door on him. He got more knife wounds and eventually collapsed. The communist mob pulled him into a hallway of a house on Zwinglis Street, number 4, and left him there to die. An autopsy was made at the Moabiter Hospital, and it was established that the boy had 5 stab wounds in his back and 2 in his chest. His face was unrecognizable, and his upper lip was totally missing. Herbert Norkus was only 12 years old, and his murderers were never caught. That's end quoting the professor of York, England, writing about communism in Germany. And this author goes on to say that does not mean that Herbert Norkus was murdered by communist Jews, who were the leading force in that uprise. Actually, by 1932, the communists had 6 million members, and the majority of them were Germans. It was a very sad part in German history. Well, think about it. Think about, though, folks, what was going on. You had the, at that time, you had the banksters who were destroying the economy, and at that time, Germany was in the throes, death throes, actually, of a terrible, terrible depression. And you know what happens when people get hungry, when they're out of work. And they become very susceptible to the mob mentality, if you would. And maybe it doesn't matter. They don't think about who they're following. They're just listening to the words that are being spoken. But 6 million members in the Communist Party in 1932, and the majority of them were Germans. It was a very sad part in German history. The Germans fought each other, and it brought it close to a civil war in Germany. The book Communism in Germany was first published in 1933 by the Anti-Communist Association. It was reprinted in America in 1990, and the back page of the reprint says it all. That was the one first they came for the communists. Well, that's all it says. First, they came for the communists. Come for the communists they did in 1933 when Adolf Hitler and his National Socialist German Workers' Party, the strongest political party in the Weimar Republic, came to hold supreme political power in Germany through entirely legal constitutional means. When Hitler became chancellor, Germany was menaced by a huge, powerful, and popular communist movement which boasted hundreds of thousands of dedicated members, had polled 6 million votes in the national election of 6 November 1932, and was unswervingly loyal to the international communist movement and its chief red dictator, Joseph Stalin. And does anybody wonder why he wanted them gone out of Germany? And Adolf Hitler did not gas 6 million Jews. There were not people gassed during after the Second World War. And from what I have read, and I suppose history would prove this out, because I've read it in more than one place, he gave them 5 years to leave. Of course, he kicked them out of every place that they could have influence in Germany. And I know I repeat myself. I know I hear myself saying things over and over again. But it does bear remembering, because they were kicked out of, the bankers were kicked out of Germany. And he kicked him out of the educational system, and he kicked him out of the government. And the newspapers were closed down, and the entertainment was cleaned up. And the people were given from my understanding, the merchants, people who had businesses, they're Jews, were given 5 years to leave and take their, with them, take their possessions and the majority, I think a percentage, a small percentage had to be left, but other than that, they were allowed to leave. He just wanted them gone. And you can certainly, I can understand that. And in Mein Kampf, it is quoted where Adolf Hitler, in fact, he at one point in time, he had said in Mein Kampf that it made him sick to see how the Jews were treated, he thought, so terribly, only just because they were Jews. And he didn't put all the people in one basket. Indeed. Oh, excuse me. Communism in Germany tells the story of Germany's peril before January 30th, 1933, when Hitler's Nazi movement was the only force capable of matching Red Terror and Red Propaganda blow for blow, word for word. Americans and Britons used to their own country's small and in recent decades ineffective communist parties will learn much about the grim realities of Bolshevism in Germany after World War I, the bloody Red Uprisings across Germany from 1918 to 23, the pitched battles and political assassinations by which the Reds attempted to smash German nationalism in the service of Stalin's Internationale, the Moscow-directed espionage and subversion aimed at the German state, and the hidden ties which linked establishment politicians, intellectuals, and financiers to communism in Germany and Russia. And that's the book, Communism in Germany. Folks, we're out of our hour here, and we're out of our week with you. We will be back with you Monday night. I hope you have a lovely 4 days while we're apart. But we're never apart because you're always in my mind. So thank you for being here. And God bless you, folks. Good night. See you Monday.
Roll away the dawn.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at firstamendmentradio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Be sure to visit the sweetliberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to firstamendmentradio.com.
The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests, and not necessarily those of the First Amendment Radio Network or its affiliated radio stations.
If you'd like to get a copy of this program, there are a few ways that we can help you. You may subscribe at firstamendmentradio.com for only $45 a month, and you'll receive an MP3 CD weekly of all of our programs. As a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online. That's a $15 value. Or you may request any month of any program on one MP3 CD for a minimum donation of only $25, or any single program on tape.